Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A little more than two decades ago, pharma giant Pfizer began airing a commercial which was so effective, there's a good chance you remember seeing it. It's that sad little hand-drawn blob whose life was changed by Zoloft.
You know when you feel the weight of sadness. You may feel exhausted, hopeless, and anxious. Whatever you do, you feel lonely and don't enjoy the things you once loved. Things just don't feel like they used to. These are some symptoms of depression, a serious medical condition affecting over 20 million Americans. While the cause is unknown, depression may be related to an imbalance of natural chemicals between nerve cells in the brain. Prescription Zoloft works to correct this imbalance. You just shouldn't have to feel this way.
Antidepressants have been a godsend for millions of people who suffer from depression. So today's show isn't about whether or not they work for some people, because they do, though they may not work for everyone. Today's show is about the fact that Pfizer and the medical community don't know exactly how they work to relieve depression symptoms, especially SSRIs, or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, such as Zoloft. So let me say that again. Doctors and researchers do not fully understand why drugs like Zoloft work. Now, you could have been fooled by that Pfizer ad, though, and millions of people were, because remember how the ad talks about depression and a, quote, chemical imbalance in the brain? That's the part of the ad with little line drawings of serotonin neurotransmitters floating around in a synapse in the brain. Now, to be fair, the Pfizer ad does say depression may be related to an imbalance of natural chemicals, but the voiceover doesn't emphasize the uncertainty. It doesn't say depression may be related to an imbalance of natural chemicals. The voiceover just kind of sails through it, which is why some studies show that as many as 85% of the public believes that chemical imbalance theory of depression, even though, again, we don't know if that's how SSRIs actually work. So that is why a study out of the UK this month drew massive attention from not only psychiatry, but the general public as well. Joanna Moncrief is a professor of psychiatry at University College London and co-author of the meta-study.
We did the study because it's been rumored in scientific and psychiatric circles for many years now that the serotonin theory of depression is not well supported by evidence. So together with my colleagues, we got together all the research and we found that none of those areas showed any convincing evidence of a link between serotonin and depression. And particularly, they did not support the idea that depression is associated with low levels of serotonin. And it is important because people have been told for three decades now that depression is due to a chemical imbalance and that they need to take antidepressant treatment to put that imbalance right.
Moncrief and her team's meta-analysis looked at large studies that already existed involving tens of thousands of patients. They could not find any relationship between the gene for a serotonin transporter and whether people suffered from depression. They also couldn't find any meaningful difference in the actual concentration of serotonin in brain fluids of people who suffer from depression and those that do not. Put together, their study concludes that, quote, there is no support for the hypothesis that depression is caused by lowered serotonin activity or concentrations, end quote. Now, to be clear, Dr. Moncrief and her colleagues are not saying that antidepressants do not work. So here's the question. If they do work for many people, but scientists don't know why, does it matter?
I think it matters a lot. I think it matters because I think how antidepressants work or what exactly they are doing, how we understand what exactly they are doing, makes a huge difference to how people evaluate them and the sort of decisions that people make about whether to take them or not.
The study has gotten a lot of pushback, but that pushback isn't about the study's methodology or its conclusions. Again, the science of how Moncrief and her team did their meta-analysis isn't at question because, as we've said, the medical community itself and pharma have always known that they don't know exactly why SSRIs work. The pushback they're getting is about the implications of the study. Some psychiatrists have accused Moncrief and her team of being anti-psychiatry.
So the controversy about our paper really worries me because we know that people have been misled about this idea about depression being a chemical imbalance for decades now. And the controversy implies that there are people out there who don't mind about that and actually would like it to have continued. And why is that the case? Because antidepressants are a multi-billion dollar business, because they've become such a well-established part of medicine and such an established part of our culture that many people have an awful lot invested in them.
That's Joanna Moncrief, professor of psychiatry at University College London. I have to say, it's been fascinating to watch the response and coverage to Moncrief's paper over the past week. And we're particularly interested in the fact that a study confirms what science already knows, or rather more specifically, doesn't know. And that study, or that finding, has come as such a shock. Well, the fact of that shock means that there's an indication of a major, major gap between what the medical community knows about antidepressants and what the public knows. So why does that gap exist? And what impact, if any, does it have on the treatment sought out and received by millions of people who suffer from depression? That's what we want to talk about today. And joining us to do so is Daniel Carlett. He's chair of psychiatry at Melrose Wakefield Hospital and publisher of the Carlett Psychiatry Report, part of the Tufts Medicine Network. About a decade ago, he published Unhinged, The Trouble with Psychiatry, A Doctor's Revelation About a Profession in Crisis. Dr. Carlett, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
Okay, first of all, let me ask you, how many psychiatric drugs are out there that we can say with confidence we know exactly how the drugs work, we know exactly the mechanism that they use to relieve the symptoms of the psychiatric illness they are prescribed for?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, there are relatively few psychiatric drugs where we say we really know how they work, and those would be drugs that, for example, are used for alcoholism, for opiate use disorder, some of the anti-anxiety drugs, some of the insomnia drugs, which is, to be fair, that's a minority of the psychiatric drugs. It is true that while the drugs do work, and, you know, I'm certainly as a practicing psychiatrist, I see them working all the time, it is true that we are humbled when it comes to our actual knowledge of the mechanisms, especially of the antidepressants.
So the norm is, more or less, that lots of drugs are prescribed that work, but we don't know how. Okay, so then why, if that's the norm, Dr. Carlett, then why do you think this meta-analysis from Professor Moncrief and her team just kind of landed with such a thud, both in the world of psychiatry and in the public at large?
I mean, first of all, I think it's a very nice paper that she and her colleagues created. I mean, it's nice to see all of this information pulled together in one place in a way that gets people talking about my favorite topic, psychiatry. So I applaud her group. Why is this causing such a stir? You know, it's kind of hard to know. I think that, yes, people have been led to believe that there is a chemical imbalance theory of depression that they are convinced is real and that it has to do with serotonin. But the fact is that for years now, and you mentioned the book that I wrote, I mean, so when I was doing research for that book, I remember reading the same studies that I'm sure Dr. Moncrief and her colleagues read, which were basically saying that there's no direct evidence of a serotonin deficiency. So it's not really new. I think, again, they were able to pull the data together in a nice way that makes it very clear. So maybe that's why it's caused such a reaction.
Okay. I think also the other part of the reaction, which we'll get into in great detail a little later in the show, is the fact that for 20 plus years now, one of the major sources of information that people have, lay people like myself, about how drugs work is through the television, okay? So we're going to come back to that in a second here. But let's just take a minute to go into a little bit more detail of Moncrief's meta-analysis. So I talked about sort of the genetic studies they looked at. I talked about the actual serotonin concentrations in brain fluids, which would not be different in people who suffer from depression and people who don't. What do you think the other sort of major finding as you read the paper is out of the meta-analysis?
Yeah, I mean, the finding is really an artifact in a sense of how complicated the brain is. I mean, we have a brain with about 100 billion neurons and with many connections between them. And it really isn't possible to just put a syringe in the brain and pull out fluid. So they had to use indirect measures such as spinal fluid. Some of the studies that she reviewed actually were post-autopsy studies where kind of gruesomely they would take brains out of people who had depression in their lifetime and do those analyses. So there were a lot of findings. But the fact is that, you know, these in psychiatry in general, the medications that we use were really discovered by accident, usually in the 1940s and 1950s. And those antidepressants were based on looking for a better antihistamine. They were tried on various patients. They were found to be extremely effective. And it was after the fact that researchers then went into the lab and tried to figure out how old drugs like imipramine or amitriptyline worked. And they found out, hey, you know, these drugs do, in fact, increase levels of serotonin and norepinephrine and several other neurotransmitters. So the natural conclusion of that would be if these drugs work and if this is what the drugs do, then depression may be related to a chemical imbalance. And I don't think that's a wrong-headed, you know, sort of conclusion that they made. The fact is that it really hasn't panned out that we've been able to come up with the direct evidence that we need.
All right. So Dr. Daniel Carlett, stand by for just a second, because we have a lot more to talk about in terms of that backstory of how then the difference between what science knows about how antidepressants work or don't work versus how the public or what the public knows about antidepressants. So we'll talk about that when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the stir caused by a major meta-analysis of the antidepressants known as selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. They come in a lot of familiar names, such as Zoloft. And this meta-analysis basically says, it confirms what science already knew, that we don't exactly know how those antidepressants work on the brain, that the central theory advanced by advertising about a chemical imbalance in the brain is maybe not how depression works. So we're trying to understand why there's a huge gap between what science knows and has known for a long time and what the public knows. I'm joined today by Dr. Daniel Carlett. He's chair of psychiatry at Melrose Wakefield Hospital. And about a decade ago, he published Unhinged, The Trouble with Psychiatry, a Doctor's Revelations About a Profession in Crisis. Now, Dr. Carlett, hang on here with me for just a minute, because I do want to explore the backstory again of the advertising around SSRIs. Again, Zoloft is the one we keep talking about, but there are others. So we spoke with Anne Harrington. She's a professor of the history of science at Harvard University and author of Mind Fixers, Psychiatry's Troubled Search for the Biology of Mental Illness. And we asked her to tell us the story of how Pfizer and pharmaceutical companies started marketing SSRIs in the 1990s.
One of the things that they did is drew on research that actually went back to the 1950s and early 60s, suggesting that the antidepressants might work by affecting levels of chemicals called neurotransmitters in the brain. The evidence that it was one of the ways that these drugs worked seemed pretty robust. These drug companies in the 1990s went back to this and said, this could be a really good story.
A really good story. Then, in 1997, the FDA made a major regulatory change. It allowed pharmaceutical companies to advertise directly to consumers. Now, the first antidepressant that went to directly advertise to consumers was Eli Lilly's Prozac. And that ad series was called Depression Hurts, Prozac Can Help. It didn't exactly use a lot of compelling visuals, like the ad that came later, which was from Pfizer. And Harrington says that Pfizer saw a golden opportunity. It launched the campaign that led with that really good story about Zoloft.
It tells a story of a adorable little blob that is very sad. And in some of the early ads, he's hiding in a cave. In another, he's like under, you know, a rain cloud. And then there's a narrator that comes on.
You know when you feel the weight of sadness. You may feel exhausted. Things just don't feel like they used to. These are some symptoms of depression, a serious medical condition affecting over 20 million Americans. While the cause is unknown, depression may be related to an imbalance of natural chemicals between nerve cells in the brain. Prescription Zoloft works.
It may be caused by a chemical imbalance in your brain. But the ad and the visuals, as the little blob obviously takes Zoloft, a bluebird alights on his shoulder and he starts to bounce around. Now, the blob was so adorable, you could have made a plush toy out of this blob. And the story was a clear, you know, you're sad, we take this drug, and the bluebird of happiness alights on your shoulder.
So that's how Harrington says pharmaceutical companies pushed the theory of a chemical imbalance.
But that's not the entire story. It was also widely used as a way to destigmatize the prescribing of antidepressants. It was also widely used by activists and advocacy groups to promote a mental health message that was really very positive, that it's not your fault. Depression was a matter of chemicals, not character.
And there's another backstory here. Well before SSRIs came onto the market, the whole field of psychiatry had undergone a major transformation. Harrington explains.
Initially, the reason this happened is that the previous paradigm, the psychosocial psychoanalytic paradigm, was seen as imploding on itself, was seen as causing enormous harm to the professional integrity of psychiatry. And biological psychiatrists stepped in kind of like the heroes to say, we need to pull back from all this crazy, expansive, psychopathologizing the world and get back to our medical mission. Psychiatry is a branch of medicine. Mental disorders are medical disorders. We have to stop blaming schizophrenia on bad mothers. We have to stop saying that homosexuality is a scourge of society. They came in on a platform of common sense, but they didn't come in on a platform of new science. What then happens is they said, just give us the money, give us more money, give us time, and the science will catch up with the rhetoric. But it never quite did.
That's Anne Harrington, professor of the history of science at Harvard University and author of Mind Fixers, Psychiatry's Troubled Search for the Biology of Mental Illness. And by the way, if you've got a question about antidepressants and what we the public know versus what science knows, hop on social media, Facebook or Twitter. We're at On Point Radio. Okay, Dr. Carlott, first of all, just so that we're dealing with a clear set of common facts here, is there any validity to the theory that serotonin in particular and levels of serotonin are a causal factor of depression in people who suffer from it? I mean, tell me what was coming out of more about what was coming out of the 1950s that even led to this theory.
Yeah, well, so the 1950s, 1960s were a time when these medications that we knew were very helpful were brought into the lab, and they were able to do experiments to show that they did seem to operate on neurotransmitters. That didn't mean that we understood that depression was caused by low serotonin, but we knew that the drugs seemed to work that way. So therefore, they thought there must be a chemical imbalance. But I remember, I mean, I did my residency at Mass General in the early 1990s, and I remember being in seminars with really the top figures in psychopharmacology of the time, and we were all extremely skeptical of this theory. And one of the reasons is that when you give an antidepressant, and anybody who's been on one knows this, it famously, there's a delay of about 2 weeks before the medication works. And so if it were a simple matter of a chemical imbalance and riding that imbalance, you would think it would work pretty much right away, but it doesn't. So we knew that there were some downstream effects that we knew nothing about. And more recently, you know, there's been newer research on brain-derived neurotrophic factor changing the architecture of the brain and changing connections between brain structures. And we're thinking that that may have something to do with how these drugs work. But you never know. It's such a complicated research topic that in 10 years we could be having this conversation about another paper debunking all of those theories as well.
Okay. I mean, speaking of debunking, we've got some listeners here who are saying they're maybe taking issue with my language and saying, a big new study, but it's not replicated yet. I will wait. Okay, well, I actually appreciate that question. Moncrief's team didn't do an original study. They did what's called a meta-analysis, right, Dr. Carlott? So can we just take a second to explain what a meta-analysis is, and can you replicate a meta-analysis?
Exactly right. So a meta-analysis is where they looked at a series of studies that have already been done. I don't know how many they looked at, but it, you know, could have been 30, 40. Some meta-analyses look at 100. These are studies that have already been done, have already been published. And what they're doing is they're trying to synthesize a wealth of data into one paper. So, yeah, to say that they need to replicate that, I think that's not typically what we require of a meta-analysis. I think we look at the paper on its own merits. And I think they did a very good job with their analysis. Mm.
And again, to emphasize, they're not saying that SSRIs don't work. It's just that the commonly understood theory of why they work can't be proven through the existing science. And I mean, it's a subtle but really, really important difference. Okay, so let's get back to this sort of backstory then about why so many people in the public including me, I'll be perfectly honest, were completely shocked by this this month. You heard Anne Harrington there talk about what she sees as a major part of this, the medicalization biology and medicalization. Medicalization isn't the right word, but searching for biological causes for psychiatric illnesses. Tell us, Dr. Carlott, when do you think that that really took hold in psychiatry, and why is it important?
Well, it really took hold sort of in the 1950s and 60s when the biological researchers began to look at these drugs. And before then, most of the treatment for depression and other psychiatric illnesses was psychoanalysis. And we knew that that worked for some people, but it didn't work for many people. So there came a period when this research was being done. And, you know, the direct-to-consumer advertising was certainly a big part of the marketing of it, as Anne Harrington discussed. And I'm not a big fan of direct-to-consumer advertising. On the other hand, I will say that I have had patients come into my office with disorders such as social anxiety disorder that were also, I think the Little Adorable Blob may have been involved in some of those ads as well. And they've said, you know, Dr. Carlott, I had no idea that what I had, this pathological shyness around people might actually have a treatment until I saw this ad. And so there, you know, and then I would prescribe medication and it could be helpful. So there's these issues, of course, are always a bit nuanced.
Okay. So you're saying that a potential positive outcome is like it raises people's awareness and they come and seek help. But what happens when if that person turns out to be one of the people for whom the antidepressant, the SSRI, doesn't work? Because there's a downside to the elegant simplicity of believing that, like, you just up your serotonin levels or prevent, you know, their reuptake in a synapse and you should be relieved of your crippling symptoms, because then if the drug doesn't work, how does that leave a patient feeling?
Right. And these drugs work for about 70% of patients. There's about 30% of patients that end up having what we call treatment-resistant depression. But I think what you're getting at is that it's not all about medications, certainly. I mean, we can't be a profession that is simply, seeing patients for 15, 20 minutes and saying, okay, here's a pill for that. However, it is true that over the last few decades, psychiatry has become primarily a profession of psychopharmacology, prescribing medications. And in fact, if you look at the data on that, I looked at this, 1996, about 45% of psychiatrists were offering psychotherapy sessions to their patients. And about 5 years ago, the data was that was down from 45% to only about 20%. And there's a host of factors that play into that. We all want our patients to get better. No one goes into psychiatry unless they have some interest in psychological functioning. And we do try to bring psychotherapy into our sessions, even the shorter ones. And sometimes that can be very helpful. But increasingly, we are referring patients from our clinic to social workers and to psychologists to do the therapy.
Okay. Well, if they can even get into your clinic, which is something I'm going to talk about with you later in the show. We should note that by virtue of these drugs being available through prescription, it means that many, many people around the world, especially here in the United States, are getting them not through a psychiatrist, but maybe through their primary care physician. That's another reason why I'm curious about the implication of this gap in understanding. The primary care physician cannot take time and isn't even qualified to do the talk therapy or that kind of cognitive behavioral therapy. They are giving the prescription, and then what happens?
Yeah, and you're right that the primary care physicians are really doing most of the antidepressant prescribing in the United States. And I think the reason for that is that, as we talked about before, these drugs are very effective and that there are many patients that are coming to us and asking for treatment and they're having a hard time getting in. The antidepressants are fairly easy to prescribe, so it does make it easy for primary care physicians to prescribe them and to prescribe the right ones. But when I ask my patients, and I have recently, as a result of this study, does it matter to you that we know what the mechanism of the medication is, of the antidepressant is? And generally, they're saying that they don't. I mean, it's very rare for a patient to come to us and say, before you write that prescription, doctor, I want you to tell me exactly what the mechanism is. What they want to know, right, is that we have done our research, that we understand that the FDA protocols are that there are placebo-controlled, randomized trials that ensure that these drugs are effective, and they just want to be better. They want to feel better.
Sure. I mean, I think most people probably couldn't even say exactly why, ibuprofen works. So, point taken. But there's just something so interesting that's happened in psychiatry over the past, 30, 40 years. And your book back in 2010 kind of landed right in the middle of it. Because remember, we heard Anne Harrington talk about the fact that, this turn towards biological psychiatry. And, she said that researchers were saying, give us more money, give us time. The science is going to catch up to the rhetoric. It never quite did. But what did catch up was the enormous amounts of money that pharmaceutical companies were making from antidepressants like Prozac, like Zoloft. I mean, they guarded those patents fiercely. They found new diseases, new conditions for which those drugs might work. In the past couple of years, even because of the pandemic, we've got a lot more people searching for Zoloft. I just saw that in 2020. The drug was in short supply because of it. So in 2010, Dr. Carla, you felt compelled to write your book Unhinged. I mean, what was going on in the profession at the time that you thought was a crisis?
There were a few things, Meghna. One of them was the disconnect between psychotherapy and medications that we just talked about. Another one was the the way in which the medical profession was starting to become overly influenced by the pharmaceutical industry. We talked about direct-to-consumer advertising, which I think most people would agree that, you know, that's just something that big businesses do. They advertise their products. We hope that they're doing it in a way that's ethical and honest, but they advertise their products. But one thing that they were also doing, which is on much, much more shaky ethical territory, was that they were paying doctors to do studies, often, in the case of Zoloft, interestingly, for a period of time, 50% of all the major studies on Zoloft that came out in big journals like JAMA and New England Journal of Medicine were actually written by ghostwriters, and doctors were paid money to put their names on them. And one of the things I wrote about in that book was the year in 2002 when I was actually involved in being a hired gun for the pharmaceutical industry, giving talks to other doctors in order to convince them to prescribe. In that case, it was Effexor.
Dr. Carlott, stand by for just a second, because now we're really getting into sort of why this gap between what science knows and what the public thought it understood is really important. So we'll talk more about it in just a minute. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, the Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just a quick heads up about what we're going to be doing a little later in this week. We're going to be talking about teenagers and sleep. I know it's August 1st already, so that means in a lot of school districts around the country, it's time to start thinking about back to school. And in California, they're pushing back high school start times to 8:30 in the morning. And that's motivated by the growing body of research that says teen body clocks are just different than adults, and they need more sleep, and they work better later in the day. So we want to hear from you. First of all, if you are a teen, how are those morning hours for you if you start school at, you know, I don't know, 7:30, which is what I did when I was a kid, or 8? Are you getting enough sleep? And if you're a parent, do you think a later start to the school day would help your teen? What do you think of the changes? What are the potential downsides, if any? Teens and sleep, we want to know your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for later in the week. Today, we're talking with Dr. Daniel Carlott. He's chair of psychiatry at Melrose Wakefield Hospital, publisher of the Carlott Psychiatry Report, part of the Tufts Medicine Network. About a decade ago, he published Unhinged, The Trouble with Psychiatry, A Doctor's Revelations About a Profession in Crisis. And we're talking specifically about the new meta study that's come out of the UK that confirms what science knew, that we don't exactly know how SSRI antidepressants work. We do know they do work for millions of people, just we don't know how. And why that landed, created such a stir in the public, the findings in that meta-analysis. So, Dr. Carlott, can I just have you repeat something really quickly? I want to know if I heard you correctly, that there was a period of time that in major journals, like the New England Journal of Medicine, some significant number of papers on biological psychiatry were ghost-written? Did I hear that right?
Yes, that's true.
How was that even possible?
Well, because the pharmaceutical companies would underwrite these studies. They were, you know, for the most part, again, placebo-controlled studies with good science behind them. But they would have the need to get them out into the journals. And the fastest way to do that for them was to hire ghostwriters to actually put the studies together and then find an expert psychiatrist to put their name on it and then to get it in the journals. So it's not something that is being done, hopefully, much anymore because journal editors have disclosure policies that are much, much clearer. But it was done. Certainly, there was one study that looked at Zoloft in particular, which was pretty amazing.
What study was that?
The one that I mentioned, that 50% of the major studies on that particular antidepressant appeared to have been ghostwritten.
I mean, if you're the psychiatrist putting your name on a paper that you had no direct relationship with the actual research, that seems pretty unethical.
Yeah, and it's not as though the doctors that were putting their names on it didn't agree with the content, and they were probably already doing their own research on some of these medications. But for them, it was sort of sometimes you get graduate students to do some of your legwork for you, and I think that's the way some of them saw this.
Did they get paid to put their names on the papers?
Yes, they did.
Wow. Okay. So I'm also seeing that, but first of all, so can we say that that's not still happening?
I would be very surprised if that's still happening.
Okay. So then in addition, again, this is about a decade ago when your book Unhinged came out. There were new requirements for disclosures from the American Psychiatric Association's annual meetings, right? And I'm looking here that found that, for example, in 2008, there were 273 speakers at the APA's annual meeting, and they disclosed that between those 273 speakers, they had signed 888 consulting contracts and 483 contracts to promote products for one and other drug company. Is that close relationship between psychiatrists and pharma still going on?
That is changing, and I'm happy to report that is changing. There was a very cozy relationship between doctors, especially psychiatrists, but other professions as well, cardiologists, et cetera, between doctors and pharma. But one thing that a lot of people don't know about the Affordable Care Act of 2010, Obamacare, is that one of the provisions was the Physician Sunshine Act, Physician Payment Sunshine Act. And what that required was that all drug companies disclose to the public all of the payments they make to doctors for any reason. And so that Open Payments website is now open. It was launched in 2013. So right now you can go to that website, federal website, you can put in your doctor's name if you're concerned, and you can find out if they are getting any payments, especially marketing payments from drug companies. So that's good. And what has happened since then is that the number of physicians that are accepting payments has gone down significantly by about 3% per year, but that has added up quite a bit so that I think doctors are feeling the pressure. They don't like their names on a federal public website showing that they're taking payments. So we're seeing a little bit less of that influence from, drug reps coming in, providing free lunches, that type of thing.
Okay. So some improvement there. That's good news. But this is why the implication of what was revealed to the public by Moncrief's et al.'s meta-analysis, I feel like it's so important. Because that's, let's say, the past 20 or 30-year period, as you're describing it, Dr. Carlott, is one that's ripe for reasons to distrust the field of psychiatry, right? Because, I mean, aren't transparency and trust just really crucially important in the relationship between science and medicine and the public?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there have been some improvements. And I think one thing that does tend to get lost in this discussion is that there have been some really exciting developments in psychiatry over these last 10 to 15 years. In terms of things that are really helping patients. For example, I told you about how antidepressants have a 2-week gap between taking them and having them work. We have now medications such as ketamine, some psychedelics like psilocybin and LSD. These are, these are sort of recreational drugs that are now being repurposed and they're being researched. Some of these drugs have effects that are within, 24 hours, especially ketamine infusions, which for patients who are profoundly suicidal and are at risk of killing themselves any day, that can really be life-saving. So there's that, and then there's several others that, again, we don't know the mechanisms, and in fact, ketamine was first studied by Yale researchers, I think, in 2008, because they were interested in, let's try something that we don't, that does clearly does not have a serotonin or norepinephrine effect, but let's see if one of these other medications helps.
Mm.
And we have been finding that they've been helping. Again, not necessarily knowing how they work, but finding that they work pretty darn well.
Yeah. So I guess that's actually, again, also good to know. And reliable and trustworthy information is so critical here. Because I have to say, I am particularly focused at the importance of trust, again, between the general public and the medical community. Because we've seen in the past couple of years how when there's a breakdown in that trust, like really bad things happen, right? There's just all the pushback, for example, that was regarding, COVID and treatments for COVID. And regarding antidepressants, we're seeing the far right already taking Moncrief's et al. Study and saying, well, now we're told that SSRIs don't work, which is not the conclusion at all. But there's an opportunity there to, further undermine trust. Is that a problem?
Well, I think that is a problem, but I think we have to put it in perspective. I mean, certainly in the rest of medicine, for example, in neurology. So if you have migraine headaches, many people do. I certainly do, maybe once a month. I'm told to take something called Imitrex. Now, if you were to ask any neurologist or any neurology researcher, first of all, how do migraine headaches work? What happens in the brain? They really are not going to be able to tell you. And if you ask them, how does Imitrex abort the headache? They're going to say, since we don't know how migraines work, we really don't know. And if you go through all of the other specialties in medicine, there are other examples of medications and disorders that we just are still learning about. The science is young. So it's not necessarily a trust issue, but it is a science issue. And we have to be a little bit humbled, especially in psychiatry, when we look at the state of science and the fact that we don't know. And it is important for us to be honest. I mean, I'm certainly not going to be telling my patients that this is a serotonin issue, although I may say, well, there may be some chemicals like brain-derived neurotrophic factor that are involved for those select patients, and there are very few of them, for those select patients that really want to know the mechanism.
Okay, so we're getting some pushback from people on Facebook, listeners saying, I wish you would stress more that the drugs work and have saved many lives. To the listener who wrote that, I literally started the show saying that these antidepressants work. We just don't know exactly how. They, in fact, work for millions of people. I literally started the show with that. And I've said it several times. Another listener, though, says, your show is just going to freak people out who are suffering and getting care from these medications. Full disclosure, I am one of those people. We are not trying to freak anybody out. I just ask that people listen a little carefully to what we're trying to do over the 48 minutes of this program. But then that same listener says, maybe if the cost of counseling was affordable and available to ordinary people, they'd get their scripts from psychiatrists and not primary care doctors. Okay, so that's actually something truly worth talking about. Because Dr. Carlott, you have mentioned that the precipitous decline in how psychiatry or the number of psychiatrists who focus on talk therapy of different kinds. We're not just talking about like Freudian psychoanalysis, right? There's cognitive behavioral therapy, et cetera. But the access to that is sorely lacking in this country, right? For so many reasons. It costs a lot. Mental healthcare professionals are already overburdened. There aren't enough of them. It's hard to get coverage for it, right? If you're lucky, your insurance company might cover, 10 appointments. That's even a lot, right? But it oftentimes takes much more than that. I mean, we're not set up for, the system isn't set up to really help people cohesively or more broadly as they're needed.
Yeah, I mean, there is more and more parity. There are parity laws where insurance companies are required to cover mental health just as they cover surgical and medical issues. But I think it's true. I mean, there is certainly a financial incentive for psychiatrists to do more short appointments because, you know, to be frank, you can make as much in a 20-minute psychopharm appointment as you can in a one-hour therapy appointment. But the other thing is that there is just a terrible human resources shortage, which has been obviously aggravated by COVID. It is extremely hard to find. I'm part of, you know, Merrill's Wakefield and Tufts Medicine. We're always looking for social workers and for therapists to help treat our patients therapeutically, and it is becoming increasingly hard to find people to hire.
Okay, so we have an interesting question here that's coming from a listener. So if it's not chemical, which again, we're not saying that it's not chemical. We're just saying that we don't know how SSRIs work. Stanzi Bliss still wants to know, what is the theory for the cause of depression, Professor Carlott?
Right. So we don't, biochemically, we do not know what the cause of depression is. I mean, I think one of the things that I do talk to some of my patients about, and I've been very, very honest in my writing, is that I too have suffered from depression. And I remember having a very, very amazing experience taking some of these SSRIs. And that 2-week gap that I talked about, I remember waking up 2 weeks after I started, I think in this case it was Celexa many years ago, actually feeling better and sort of the weight of the world was lifted from my shoulders. So when people wonder to me whether these medications really work, one of the things I do is, you know, to decrease stigma and to let people know that I have had the actual experience is to tell them that story.
Well, I mean, I'll add to that. Again, I think we should decrease stigma. So I actually took Zoloft many, many years ago, and I was just in this intense period of several years of this. I felt like my brain was just like stuck in concrete. And that was, you know, and that was the physical sensation of the depression I had. And again, after, for me, it didn't take quite 2 weeks. It took a little less than that. The first thing I felt was a sense of lightness and clarity. Like then I could actually function better. And it helped me get the most out of the talk therapy I was also getting at the time. So I was lucky enough to be able to get sort of the two-pronged treatment. I went off of it later. And then, again, a couple of years ago, I went back on a different antidepressant. Now I'm taking Lexapro. And again, it's like very much a powerfully positive effect on me in terms of my N equals one. So we're not saying they don't work. We're just saying that we don't know exactly how some of them work. And I guess, finally, Dr. Carlott, where does this leave the millions of people who are suffering from some form of depression? I mean, for those who haven't received help or unable to receive help, what should they do?
Well, they should be encouraged by the fact that there's a lot of research going on in other modalities. So I talked about the ketamine and the psychedelics, but there's also brain modulation techniques like transcranial magnetic stimulation that is also very helpful. A number of therapies. One of the, you mentioned insomnia in adolescence. One of the big success stories in psychotherapy is cognitive behavior therapy for chronic insomnia. And that can be delivered actually just as effectively via an app online as it can in person. So we're using the newer technologies to augment the already effective methods that we're using to help people.
Well, we've got 30 seconds left, though, and I want to ask one last thing of you, Dr. Carlott. Do you still think overall in the profession there's an overemphasis on the biological origins of depression?
I don't think so. Okay. I think that there is, we will find out more and more, and we will, more importantly than understanding the mechanism, is using that understanding to develop better treatments. And I think the combination of some psychotherapy with biological treatments is really the way to go for most patients.
Well, Dr. Daniel Carlott, Chair of Psychiatry at Melrose Wakefield Hospital, publisher of the Carlott Psychiatry Report, and author about a decade ago of Unhinged. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Carlott.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.